Welcome to Holden Village's Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Educational Network and Support. The subject of this morning's session will be Staying Focused, Nourished, and Healthier with our speaker, Dr. Hartung. Let's listen in.
I thought, in contrast to trying to sort of deliver the paper of whenever that was that Tuesday night? I'd like to share this morning some things that I found valuable for myself and my own life around issues of ministerial health, burnout, and things like that. To focus on issues related to keeping nourished and focused and supported, our Concordia Health Plans is stingy with data. Perhaps also with benefits. But when we gathered under the old system of managed care with preferred health care leaders in the four regional offices that were managing the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's mental health and substance abuse care, when we gathered them together and ask them, well, what are you hearing? What are the diagnostic things with which people are coming forward as they're calling for help? In their statistics, the diagnostic category or symptom that emerged 6-1 over every other symptom that is presenting complaint. The diagnostic symptom that emerged 6-1 over any other presenting complaint was a cluster of things that could be called, could you guess it? Hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids, right? It's not bad for an anal retentive church. The symptom cluster, and most of you were right, those of you who took that question seriously, the symptom cluster that emerged most graphically was depression. Not anger or even anxiety disorders, but people who felt alone, burdened, depressed, energyless, more or less. We tried to work in relationship to that in terms of what then, if that's what, in terms of people that are coming forward or experiencing, then what might we do to help that? Principle one about health is that health is not a singular action. Marty's thing about Luther and the Ten Commandments was wonderful this morning in relationship to that, because it's not I, it's we. And as Leonard Sagan in his book, The Health of Nations, suggests, the unit of health is not the individual, it is rather the community. It is not possible to simply, as our last president said, well, if we want a healthier nation, everybody should run. It's not as simple as that, because the threats to health are much more complicated and communal. And issues of health are community-based, not just individual-based. So to approach issues of professional church worker depression or professional church worker health, one approaches not just the individual, but the community and the health or lack of it of the community. As I said, either here or at the fireside chat, can organizations make people sick? Recent study of top-level executives of automobile firms in Michigan indicated that their adolescent children were using psychiatric and substance abuse services at the rate of 35% of the adolescents there, that is, enrolled, which is a tad more than the 10 to 15% that was being accessed or being used by those who were not in management positions of the same companies. Now, there may be lots of reasons for that, but is it possible that organizational style, organizational culture, organizational demand has something to do with health, and it's not just eat better, exercise more, but it also has to do with community relationships? If so, then the characteristic of our community life becomes fairly central. Now, I'm going to move back and forth because I have a couple of slides here. Holden was very nice to pull this down, and Jamie was wonderful to create this thing, so I've got to use it now, even if I... And this will pick me up, will it? We'll see. In figures from the National Center on Health Statistics, you probably know this already. So you remember that I vacillate in my ambivalence between having something to present that's maybe new and innovative and figuring that everybody knows everything that I'm saying already. You may know this already, but if you take the general sense of what it is that is the source of our health on a secular plane, see, what makes you sick and what keeps you healthy? The general consensus these days, since we have most microbes and diseases under control, sort of, more or less, in the general population, that the medical care system, I prefer to call that the disease care system, because it has very little in it that is preventive or wellness oriented, at least that's paid for by our plans. The medical care system accounts for perhaps 10% of health issues. Environmental issues, the air we breathe, the safety of our neighborhoods, account for perhaps 20%. And heredity or genetic issues account for another 20. That leaves broadly 50%. I mean, this is sort of crass, broad brush stroke stuff, but leaves about 50% of our health having to do with things related to personal lifestyle choices. What we choose to eat, how we choose to treat our bodies, the relationships that we have with each other, the people that we choose with whom to have relationships, the people that we don't choose to have relationships with, and the quality of those. Virginia Satir, a noted family therapist, suggests that we all need at least 8 hugs a day to thrive. When I'm feeling especially down, I change that figure to 15. And sometimes I'll go as low as 6. But it's the relationship component that helps us thrive. We know from the emerging studies in psychoneuroimmunology, I've practiced a long time to try to say that word, that certain characteristics of the immune system are suppressed in the contexts of unsafe and negative relationships. and that certain characteristics of the immune system are strengthened within the characteristics of healthy and warm and affirming relationships. Could it possibly be true then that the hospitable, warm, embracing receptivity of God and the resulting warmth, receivingness and hospitality of the community is in fact a life-giving force that our confessional forebearers kind of were getting at when they talked about the mutual admonition and consolation of members of the body of Christ. If so, then this whole business that you've heard for most of your career probably in life, that it's important to have particularly supportive and helpful relationships, the development of support systems, tends to be a matter not only of psychological health, but of also perhaps physical health as well. Oh dear. It's fine. Whoa! Now that's a narcissistic transfusion right there. Yes. I recommend to you, by the way, Anthony Pappas's new book that's put out by Alban. Pappas is P-A-P-P-A-S, and the book is called Pastoral Stress, Sources of Tension, Sources for Transformation. He lists building support systems as a major health issue for all of us. But anyway, here we go on this. What are the forces in our profession that make the development of support systems and other health-related initiatives so important because of the vulnerabilities that are involved in simply the culture of who we are as professional church workers, lay people in ministry, and other folks who serve folk? Ayala Pines suggests these characteristics of being in service to other people. She does this out of a whole couple of decades now of studies of burnout, stress, and depression in folk. Do you know, for instance, that the average length of service of a new social worker in the New York City system is 9 months? But I wonder what the average length of service for church workers in First Call is and why. Nonetheless, we'll go through the first because it's not a lot. In modern industrial societies, professional organizations perform many of the functions traditionally met by the extended family of the community. Well, okay. This is particularly true in the treatment of personal or interpersonal problems. Now, she's suggesting that we are in a cluster of professions that serve folks, that are human service or people-based, even though we may be Christ-centered, we are in our activities people-directed. The result is a large number of medical, educational, social, and psychological services. These human services are performed by millions of professionals, including ourselves, who share three basic characteristics. One, we perform emotionally taxing work. Two, we have certain personality characteristics that generally helped us choose ministry as a career. And three, we share a client-centered orientation. Are we done? Okay. One, I believe that one of the things that at least our people that I talk to have at issue for themselves is that they have long since steeled themselves from the reality that they are in emotional, that we are in emotionally tough work. That, in fact, it's not just the administrative toughness of a parish or ministry in a cynical culture, as I tried to point out last time we talked. It is also being with people at times of huge and grievous emotional consequences. And it is not possible to be with people at times of deep emotionality, deep distress and joy, deep human angst, without sharing at some level in that experience and being affected by it. It is possible to consider that the ministry is a series of small or larger stresses and traumas with which we walk alongside of our people. And because of that trauma and stress, we could, without knowing it, develop versions of a post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really backing off from the emotional intensity of the experiences which we have. A cure, of course, or at least a road toward more health, is indeed to recognize the deep emotional connections and effects that our work has on us as we walk with people who themselves are deeply emotionally affected. I was at Lutheran General in Chicago when the DC 10 or L-1011 or whatever it was, went down at O'Hare. Of the first responders to that crash, that is the emergency medical people who responded to that crash, 3 years later, when studied, 85% of them were no longer in emergency medical service. The trauma of being with the trauma of others is overwhelming. And the issue of critical incident stress debriefing, which is within 24 hours, 48 max, of an event of first responders, get people together to initially talk about where they're at, because by 72 hours, or 100 at the latest, it'll all be buried because it's too horrific. Except it won't be buried. It'll continue to surface, but it'll surface in undigested and difficult ways. The community gathers. Susan's wonderful picture of Lazarus and the community, the necessary community response. The community gathers to unbind the burial cloths. Well, that principle is true for people who are involved in trauma and stress issues with others, even if it's not just your own trauma. That's the emotionally taxing piece. So where would it be that we ourselves have the capability in our own lives to disinvest ourselves of the kind of emotional impact that walking with people in deep emotional situations has? To say nothing of the emotional impact of being in settings that themselves are at times at least, difficult and stressful just ordinarily. So there is ordinary emotionally taxing stuff, and there is extraordinary emotionally taxing stuff, either one of which, as we receive it, and we will, something happens to us. We change and are different and have a response emotionally, cognitively inside. We don't want that response to simply lay inside and bounce around in negative ways. We do want to find ways to deal with the emotionally taxingness of our profession. And I think that at least the first step is to say, this is emotionally taxing work. If we're going to walk with people in deep levels of their stress and anxiety, it is tough emotional work. Second characteristic is that we share certain personality characteristics. Now, that's, of course, not true for everybody, but by and large, people go into human service professions in order to be useful to somebody. That actually makes us pretty dependent on people to be useful to. What would happen if we gave a party for our usefulness and nobody came? The business of wanting to be pastor, wanting to be minister, wanting to be helpful to folks requires a cooperativeness or a desire together. Try pastoring someone who doesn't want to be pastored or helping someone who doesn't want to be helped. We need others. That's part of our characteristics. We want to be useful. It's hard on us if we're not. That's been panned some as a characteristic. I think it's a wonderful characteristic. What would you like, rather? People who don't give a crap about anybody? On the other hand, it does put us in situations in which we do need others. And finally, we share a certain client-centered orientation, and that I tend to put as people can do to us what we dare not do to them. Think of it for a moment. I am in my office, and a client that I've been working with comes in who's particularly grieved at me. Maybe I've made a therapeutic mistake, my one a year that I make. Who knows? Client comes in and says, Hartung, you are without a doubt the worst therapist that I have ever been with, and I've seen six. You are unempathic, you don't understand, you go to sleep on me, you're out to lunch, you're no help, I'm getting worse. You are awful, I think I'm going to report you to the licensing board. This is just absolutely bad. I'm going to think of all the people that I can talk to say, you are a lousy, lousy therapist, you are junk food. Now, I say, well, you think that's something. I've been in practice for 25 years, and you are the lousiest patient I've ever had. I am not permitted, although I wish. I am stuck, in a way, as a receptor, not as a mutual back and forther. People can do to us or with us what it is professionally not possible without great risk to our profession that we do to us or we do to them. What do you think? as a voters assembly meeting or a church council meeting and somebody gets very angry and starts yelling at you. Somehow that's kind of acceptable. At least it's within the bounds of what we kind of understand. But will your bishop or district president hear of it if you then start yelling and screaming back? There's a relational imbalance, in other words, when there is a service person, professional, whatever, clergy, layperson, providing a service, that the person who is receiving the service gets to do things that we can't do. That then allows us to be receptors. We get stuck with the emotional stuff connected with that exchange. And so what do? I go home and find somebody else. Or go somewhere to find somebody else to dump it and dump it and dump it, and the dumping goes on. I've been dumped on. I can't in that situation do it, so I go do something else. My marriage suffers, or my relationship with my kids suffer, or my relationship with my dog suffers, or heavens knows what. So what we've got in ministry in terms of looking at these characteristics, and I hope this is a sort of a useful way to begin to perceive some of the things that may actually, if they don't happen to you, I want you to know they happen to me. And perhaps we have some commonality there. The work that we do is tough emotionally, especially if we're walking with people at the level of their deep emotional hurt and pain and difficulties. It's even difficult work when we walk with people in their great joys, because that's all high emotional business. We need people in order to be of use to them, and we are bound by certain standards related to our behavior. The net result, therefore, is that we have a huge vulnerability to become the singular containers for all this emotionality and stress. We have the vulnerability to be the sponges that are impacted by events of in other people's lives and also by people's interactions with us, but have not the opportunity in those connections to process and digest what it is that we're feeling and thinking. Our vulnerability then is that it stops in our insides and begins to wreak havoc with our own immune system, in our relationships, and in our affect. There are a number of ways to begin to address this, but the notion of the community, as different from the notion of the individual entrepreneur, seems to be the most appropriate way to begin to approach this. It's very clear to me that various social systems demand things of us and affect emotionally things inside of us and our relationships, and that the development of a significant level of support systems represents a very important way, one of a number, to be able to work out some of these vulnerabilities. After all, the point of addressing or laying out vulnerabilities is also to suggest, well, what it is, when we recognize what the vulnerability is it possible to target what kinds of things would help that vulnerability? One thing that clearly helps is the development of support systems. The problem with the development of support systems is that there are many things to be supported. In my graduating class, Concordia Seminary, 1967, of the 10 couples that were our best friends, 6 marriages were in deep trouble after the first year. All of them happened to be suburban-urban couples who'd been sent to Roundup, Wyoming, or at least rural. They'd been sent cross-culturally with no support systems. Their marriage was in trouble because all of a sudden they had moved from this vast set of support systems that had been in seminary, and they only had each other. And it overwhelmed the system because there was too much. And regardless of the great reservoirs of love and respect that we may have for each other as husband and wife or friend and friend, it is relationships can get too much into them. So, with that in mind, I'd like to suggest that we do a little exercise. I was going to make copies of this, but then I thought, well, do I use up paper or electricity? So I chose electricity, assuming that if you wish to look at this further, you'll have an opportunity to at least write it down. I believe that this sort of way of looking at support issues helps me understand sometimes what I need in the way of a support system, and I don't get stuff cross-purposed. Additionally, I think it's important to try to determine how important various aspects of this in terms of our support systems are. So I'm going to run through the 6 support issues. Support in relationship to listening. Now, what I'm really going to asking you to do is to think about, as we define these, how important is that to you? Who in your life provides that function? That is, that you can turn to for that? And how well is it satisfied? Okay. Now, this particular form uses a 1-7 scale on both items. So, for instance, if listening is a 6 for me, and I list 3 or 4 people who I can turn to listen to me, but then I say, how fulfilled do I feel with that, and I come up with a 2, I have a huge vulnerability there. Something's very important to me in terms of a support system, but I don't have people in my emotional surround that are fulfilling that very well. And if the unit of health, actually the stuff that I say sometimes holds together, if the unit of health is the community and lifestyle accounts for 50% of the health, and I have some responsibility for developing that, then I know that part of my task is to put into my social system, or as Marino used to say, put into my social atom, people who can satisfy those needs. Since we've already determined that the characteristics of ministry make us very vulnerable if we stay individual entrepreneurial. Vulnerable to our emotions and even our bodies and immune system. Listening. People who will actively listen to me without giving advice or judgment. How important is that? Somebody or people who you can go to and just say, I have something that I'd like to talk about. Will you just hear me out? And who will? This is one of the early and in some ways continuing issues that Judy, my wife, and I have. She is a doer. I am more of a painter or storyteller, although I don't think I tell stories well, but I just sort of, it takes me a while to get to my point. David Ludwig, one of our writers in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, talks about painters and pointers. You know, pointers are people who, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, here's the point. If you listen to their topic sentence or their paragraphs, you know everything else they're going to say. And painters are people that if you listen to their topic sentence and go after that, you'll be lost forever because it takes them a while. They don't even know what their point is, really, until they get there. They need to put it out on the table. So for me, for instance, listening is extremely important. To have listeners is extremely important because sometimes I don't really know where I'm at until I have somebody that I can put it, that can help me put it into words. I don't have it figured out in any way before I start. Judy, as a pointer, in our early relationship at least, took the first thing that I said and tried to fix it. So I'm saying I'm having this difficulty at work with this person, and I just like to bounce it off of you. I'm having this sort of idea that such and such is going on, and she'll say, well, have you talked with them? Well, I don't want anybody to ask me a question. I want somebody to listen. See, it's a cross-purpose issue. So I've learned to say, I know this may be hard on you, Judy, for a moment, but please give me 5 minutes. And that works. That is, I can signal ahead of time what it is that my need is, if my need is listening. But anyway, to get back to this, people who will actively listen to me, not giving advice or making judgment, I need to talk about such and such. How important is that on a scale of 1 to 7 for you? Who in your life? Now see, this is where the serious work goes on. Who in your life is there that you can call on to do this? And on a scale of 1 to 7, how fulfilling is it for you? We're trying to work at a danger and a vulnerability. The vulnerability is that as individual entrepreneurial types, we have all this emotionality and emotionally taxing work and client-centeredness and inability, not permission to do unto others as we've been done to. We've had all this stuff cascading on us, and the question is, how is it that we can discharge some of it in healthy ways? And one answer is the development of a social support system, and one part of support is having people who simply will hear us out without advice, making advice or judgment. The second arena is technical support. Who in our lives, well, I'll define it first. It is people who can tell us when we've done something in our profession well. You know Blanchard in the 1 Minute Manager who goes around and they did this assembly line question, when do you see your boss? And the answer is when I've done something wrong. So the immediate sort of issue is boss comes, something's wrong. Or when do you see a policeman on the highway when I've been speeding? You know, that kind of business. And his management thing is you hang around people, try to catch them doing something right, and then applaud. How important is it for you to be caught doing something in your profession right and to have it recognized? The Dobson system has developed this wonderful thing. October or something is Clergy Appreciation Month. Well, now, come on. Isn't it something if people when people that we trust, who know our field, come up to us and say, "That was really a terrific hospital call you made." Or, "That was a," now I'm LCMS, "a wonderful division of Law and Gospel, you know." Or, "Our synodical president would have been proud of that sermon." In order to have technical appreciation in your support system, you need somebody whose opinion you trust, who has integrity, and who knows the field. That's why people who come out from your parish, at least in my experience when I preach, people who come out and say, nice sermon, Pastor, that doesn't affect me at all. Now, if somebody says, "I was really moved in my life and it meant this to me," that's a different thing. And if a speech professor at the local university comes out and says, "That was a wonderfully crafted and energetic way to do preaching," see, that's different. That's what's that's the technical support piece. Clergy are especially vulnerable to this because most of us exist in individual practices. And whether or not there is a safety system that allows us to share what it is that we do with each other. I mean, when last have you videotaped a sermon and brought it to your colleagues? Or a hospital call, or chairing an administrative meeting, or something like that in terms of that sort of feedback. That's all support system stuff, because who can tell you you've done a good job that will really get to you in your soul? Well, the only way to do that is to have people look at your job, and my goodness. But anyway, how important is that to you? And who in your life is there that are in a position to fulfill that, and how well? Technical challenge is the same principle except the challenge part. See, it's both appreciation and challenge. In your preaching that, you went off for 5 minutes and kind of it was hard to know where you went. Have you thought about doing this? Your exegesis was a little troublesome. Let's work on that together. You really shouldn't have blown your nose in the middle of the president's report to the congregation. How important is technical challenge? Because, see, too much comfort is a problem, too. Critical, knowledgeable colleagues who can challenge thinking, stretch us, encourage us to attain greater heights. We know that people who are growing, who see themselves as learning in what they're doing, are more buffered to burnout than folks who are in a routine. If I'm in a small group setting in which we're discussing hospital calls, the hospital, and I'm learning something and we're reading, the hospital calls that I'm making have a quite different tone than if this is the 100th hospital call that I got to make this month. The learning, growing stuff is really pretty important. So technical appreciation, technical challenge, two sides of that technical coin. Emotional support, people willing to be on a person's side in difficult situations, even if they're not in agreement with the person. People who are willing to stand at your side, even if they don't agree. Because agreement is not the issue, standing at your side is. These people need no technical expertise. It requires somebody who cares about you as a human being rather than cares about the task or the position that's being espoused in the moment. Who will retain emotional connection with us even if we're walking a road or taking a position with which someone doesn't agree. How important is that, to have someone that you can call on and ask to be at your side, to walk with you? The colleague to do that doesn't have to be in agreement. They just need to be able to be with you. An emotional challenge, so how important on a scale of 1 to 7, who's in your life to do it, and how's it being fulfilled? Emotional challenge is people who will question you. I have one colleague that I sort of count on to do that at a particular meeting that I go to. I was there actually Friday before I came here. I was feeling quite I don't know how I would describe how I was feeling. I just knew that I was going to be gone for quite a long time, and I was a little unfocused and even more hyper than usual and all that kind of business. So this guy, during the course of the meeting, says, "You seem to be a little beside yourself today. Can we talk about that before we do any more business?" Well, of course, my first response is, "Oh, God." It was an emotional challenge. It's not just to be supported and to have people walk with. It's also to have in one's life people who will challenge where you're at emotionally, who will wonder if you're angry when you don't think you are, but your face is all red, who will wonder if you're anxious when you're shaking, but are not in tune with that, who will wonder if you're sad, if your eyes water, but you're not ready yet to speak it. The challenge is to connect that way. How important, who's there, and how fulfilled is it? And sharing social reality is people in your life that can help you reality check. If you had this experience, great. You might even be having this experience now, for all I know, although the next characteristics would not be characteristics of me, but somebody who's supposed to be pretty good at what they're doing comes and talks, and it's not going anywhere, and it's dull and boring and awful and everything. But this is an expert, see? So I think to my, when it happens to me, what do I think? I say, must be something wrong with me. You know, expert's there, I'm not with it, must be me. I mean, I just do that naturally. I mean, it must be me. Then, if the lights were on, I'd look around, and somebody else yawns, and somebody else is asleep, and somebody catches my eye, and we sort of either, whatever we do, my wife says, my eyebrows go up, and their eyebrows go up, and we've made a connection, and I've got a comrade who feels the same way as I do. I've reality checked. It's not only me. Who in your life is there that you can call on to check out stuff? In this meeting, I felt like I was being picked on. Did you see it that way? I was at the hospital, and I felt like, almost did for a little bit, cry with the people. It was so emotionally draining. Do you think that's weird? People that you can check out stuff with and test the reality of what's so. Okay, now, where you have high importance and low fulfillment, there will be your major vulnerability in the support system arena, where you have high importance and high fulfillment. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Foster and nourish those relationships so they stay there. So there is a celebration and fostering of things that are high important and highly fulfilled, and there becomes an awareness of the vulnerability that we have, where there is a high importance but a low fulfillment. Support systems are one of a number of things that can help us in terms of dealing with our characteristics of being in ministry and our vulnerabilities. I commend all images, biblical and otherwise, of community to you. And I hope that it's possible that in some ways where we might go with a Lutheran theological thing is to develop a community understanding of the images like body of Christ and all that kind of stuff. I've really appreciated being with you, and to repeat the words of 1 John, since I think we're out of time. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. Thanks.